Welcome to Bridging the Gap. We are Alaskans discussing issues that divide us in order to find solutions that will unite us. Welcome to Bridging the Gap. Today is the 14th in a series of panel discussions of Alaskans examining issues that divide us politically in these turbulent times. My name is Paul Thomas. I live in Trapper Creek. The objective of our panel discussion is to derive, through questions posed to the participants, an understanding of the causes that have resulted in the current polarization of American political discourse. Subsequent to achieving a satisfactory understanding of the causes, it is hoped that through further discussion, a strategy for positive interaction can be constructed, which can achieve a respectful accommodation of each side towards the other. Today we are talking about the two-party system. With us, we have our double-hatted engineer slash panelist, Mike Molesky, who's with us for the second time in that capacity, Tony Jensen, and Judy Donegan. Okay, before we even get into this talk about the two-party system, I just want to briefly get a little comment on what we saw from your perspective of personal approval or disapproval with the March for Life with the kids from Parkland High School that they just had on at Washington, D.C. Can we get any go ahead, Mike.
Well, I personally thought it was extraordinary. I think that a number of the observers who, in describing it, noted that the timing may be right for an entire group of population who have been there and recognized, but not really listened to in the same way.
Which is the student component of what we're going to be talking about today.
Exactly.
Which is not today, but later on, where you talk about education.
And, of course, the advantage we have here is that we had a student-organized event, a series of events, actually, and we were able to interview one of the organizers, a young man, a junior at Palmer High School, came in. We talked with him, and we're very much impressed with the organization, the connection to the administration, the superintendent of schools, all those people, and the articulation of the purpose beyond a single kind of soundbite. We brought him in afterwards, after the event, and he himself was surprised. I think that was one of his basic responses at how successful and how powerful it seemed to be. And in discussion, just as you're pointing to the future, pointing out that this wasn't a one-off, that this, if anything, catalyzed another level of participation beyond the study of perhaps civics and government.
Well, the three main events I saw was right after the shooting, they got together and called the BS. Then they had the walkout, the national walkout, and then they had the March on Washington. So that was three-pronged there.
Sure.
You know, all highly organized. Tony, anything happened at your school?
Nothing happened at Wassel High School in terms of a march specifically. It was things that they talked about, and in relating to what Mike had said, as a civics teacher and a leadership teacher and just a teacher in general, this kind of student engagement really is right up the alley of what I try to talk about in class, because this is exactly what we want our students to do. We want them to be engaged in the civic process. It's not always that you agree with what they have to say. And in this case, I think many people do agree with what they're talking about. But just seeing the students take this kind of role and take an active participation role in government is exactly what we need them to do when it comes to this issue, along with other issues, and that now as an engaged electorate, they are willing to go out and then vote. And we know that young people don't tend to vote in a large capacity or a large amount. And so if this is something that drives them to the ballots and gets them to vote for the things that they would like to see, it is equally their country as it is the older people's country. And so this is something we should be encouraging them to do.
Okay, before I get to Judy, I just want to ask a little qualifying follow-up here. You clearly promote that the students' activity in this is good for for them, for America,
sure.
For our future. Is the rest of the administration or is the educational establishment as a whole feel the same way you do about this issue?
Well, it's a little tricky in this sense because you are talking about civil disobedience,
mm-hmm.
right? Because if we're talking about like what Palmer High School did, they did a walkout and they stayed out for 17 minutes and then went back into class. And they did a wonderful job of working with their administration. And their my understanding is that their administration supported that and were there and they brought in some other groups and they made an event out of it. And that's really good. Another avenue to have taken is that students have the ability to walk out of class, whether their teachers or their principals agree to that, they still have that right to protest.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I talk about in my civics class is that they have to be willing to accept the consequences.
Correct.
If they're going to try to change the system, they have to accept the consequences of what that might be. And, you know, we see this with the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s and other times. And so I am fully an advocate for students to do that. But I also know my capacity as a teacher. I can't tell them to do that because then I'm...
You're still the authority figure.
Yeah, and yeah. I'm undermining maybe what my administration had said or what my school district administration had said, and I'm fully cognizant of that part too. And so we didn't organize anything
specifically. It's kind of the dynamic is just pretty tricky there. Yeah.
It is, but as a theoretical thing and a hypothetical thing, in my civics classes, we definitely have talked about this as a walkout, as a form of protest that they're allowed to do with some potential consequences, or maybe if they had worked with the administration like the students at Palmer High did, there was some sort of compromise and they can make it a school educational awareness type of thing, and that's also equally valid.
Educational experience.
Absolutely.
Judy, what was your take on all that?
Well, I was very, very impressed with what those kids did and with the individual. I mean, there were so many kids that from Stoneman Douglas High School that did remarkable things. They were so articulate. They knew the issues. They seemed to know how to organize. One thing I read recently also along with your statement about the three things they did, that now they're planning to urge people to demand town hall meetings.
Mm.
In the districts, which might be interesting. And then the other thing is that along with education, Stoneman Douglas is a remarkable high school, I think. And it's a fairly wealthy high school. It's a very large high school. But it also is a high school that continues to have extracurricular.
The things that Tony is saying he wants his students to do.
Right.
Yes.
It has a great drama department. A lot of these kids were drama
mm-hmm.
students.
Mm-hmm.
It had a debate, a strong, apparently the whole county has a strong debate emphasis. So these kids were trained, not for this thing, but for whatever came along. And then they were able to sort of rise to the occasion.
They had the toolkit.
They did.
To
I
get
think.
The message across.
And it might not just be those kids. I haven't been with high school students.
I think the place where my kids went to school in Pennsylvania, I'll just plug it right now, Greensburg-Salem, also had that kind of culture where education was important. And the principals, you know, the administrators, maintained contact. There was a guy there, Mr. Murphy. He was always going around the halls, and he had a personal relationship with every student that he encountered.
Yeah, my son was lucky enough to go to a school like that as well. And ironically, with the same kind of strong, not that he was in drama, but it did have the same kind of strong drama department, the extracurricular activities, very strong support from the community. It was a much smaller school. But
if I can interject one thing on that same idea.
Sure.
I wear a few different hats for the school district, and one of the other things that I do is I'm the student advisory board advisor for the school district, and so I get to work with students from every single secondary school in our school district. And what you're talking about, where you went to school or where your son went to school, that's actually indicative of a lot of our schools, even in the Matsu Borough.
Mm-hmm.
We have this narrative nationwide. We have this narrative that our public schools are failing, that our kids are doing terrible, and all these other things, but my experience is that our kids are really well-developed, and it's kind of doesn't matter where you go to school. A lot of our public schools do really good things. The Matsu Valley kids are no different from that. They have some really exceptional things that they're able to do, and our students really are good And we need to give them a lot more credit than what we tend to do, because as adults, we kind of say, oh, the kids these days. And that's been said for millennium.
Well,
and our kids
Parkland,
are really doing
the Parkland well. Kids put that on full display.
Yes.
And they're continuing
they
to do that. All right. This is Bridging the Gap. We are on KVRF, Radio Free Palmer, Big Cabbage Radio. We're discussing one of the many issues that divides us politically. We started off with this gun resistance of the Parkland kids, but now we're going to talk about our two-party system. We have Mike Molesky here and Judy Donegan and Tony Jensen. And I want to start off with a discussion with a little narrative so the audience can get a little bit of the history in case they forgot. Although there is no mention of political parties in our Constitution, it didn't take long after 1787 for two major parties to form. The Federalists, led by Alexander Hamilton, and the Democrat-Republicans, led by Thomas Jefferson, known at that time as the Republicans. With the emergence of Andrew Jackson, the party of Jefferson started calling themselves Democrats and have since that time. And the Federalists merged into the Whigs. As the Civil War approached, the Whigs joined forces with the abolitionists and formed the present-day Republican Party, their second nominee and first president being one Abraham Lincoln. Since that time, for 162 years, we have been stuck with the donkey and the elephant. Every president elected has been a nominee of one of those two parties. That's the history. Has it worked out beneficially for us as a nation or not?
Sometimes.
Okay, I kind of dumbfounded everybody there. Sometimes it's worked out beneficially, the two-party system.
Well, sometimes we've had pretty good results from it.
Okay. Some examples of those good results?
Well, I would say Abraham Lincoln. I mean, I hate to be obvious. Franklin Roosevelt.
Okay.
I would say Obama. But
okay. So would a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, has it been beneficial, Tony?
Well, I was going to say what's interesting about Judy's comments is that the times, the presidents that you mentioned are actually were during times of turmoils within the political parties. So you're actually seeing an emergence of a new political party with this
exactly.
conglomeration of all these other things for the early Republicans, for Lincoln. And then you're seeing a shift in ideology and that with the Democrats for Roosevelt. And you could even advocate that there's probably some shift that was occurring,
so
especially for the Republicans when Obama was elected.
Where was that shift, ideological shift with Roosevelt?
You're seeing a tightening of the Democratic Party in terms of trying to create like an actual firm platform. It had been sort of you had a group of like populists and some progressives and some other groups similar to what was happening with the demise of the Whig Party with around the time the Lincoln and the Republicans emerged. So you're seeing that, and what Roosevelt was able to do is actually bring those different competing factions within the Democratic Party together to create the concept of what we think of as the Democratic Party currently.
So you're basically saying he expanded into all these other interests
well,
to make a bigger
tent?
Well,
he kind of consolidated it. One of the things, because your question is kind of leading, but the idea is, well, what's the alternative? Like a one-party system isn't going to be working because almost every country we see with the one-party system is going to be some of a totalitarian state, you know, some sort of dictatorship.
Well, we're going to get to the one parties here a little
and
later.
And your multi-party
on.
Systems are going to cause this Madison's concept of hyperpluralism to the extreme where we're not going to see a lot of effectiveness. The government actually works in the way it was designed. It just happens to be one more check and balance that we've created through this two-party system has lent itself towards fulfilling the goals of what the framers were talking about for the Constitution.
Can I take that as a yes, beneficial?
I think that it's working by design, so I think, yes, it is
okay.
Mostly beneficial.
Mike, beneficial or not?
I like Judy's maybe. I would use another M word, mixed. Obviously,
mixed results?
Mixed results,
okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
You've identified certain times in history when we could perhaps say that the system has functioned better in terms of the results. Obviously, looking at a presidential election. But my experience has been more on the, if you will, the local level, state level. I have noticed in particular over the last couple of decades a change to bring us to the point we are today, where it's hard to deny that we have this kind of loggerhead situation, where we have, some would say, an extreme here versus an extreme there. And in the past, we've tended to say, well, there's this large group of people in between who sort of wash back and forth. They may go to one party or the other, maybe independents, and they act somewhat as a buffer.
So the extremists have been absorbed, and the more moderate voices?
I think I would sum it up this way, Paul. I think the extreme elements that identify within each party have dominated the conversation. And that has not been to the benefit of the country, and I worry at the present time, and that's why I say, although over the years this two-party system has been something people could refer to and think about, relate to, be part of, at the present time, it doesn't feel that way, and we can talk more about it later.
I think there's another way in which. You talked about extremism, but the Democrats used to be sort of the party of the people, labor unions and so on, and the Republicans, the white-collar, business-oriented people. I read something recently that said that
flipped.
You know, it's not working as it did, and that's why we have this whole swath of people who feel disenfranchised. Because money has taken such an important role in the elections for Democrats as well as Republicans. So you have, he describes it as an educational elite with the Democrats and a merchant or business elite with the Republicans running things. And then you have all these people out there that are just feeling disenfranchised. Well, basically.
Yeah, the political parties themselves have actually flopped ideologies a few times. And so this might be the next natural part of that. But I guess I would advocate that it's not necessarily a party in the party system that's sort of failing. It might be the nominating process that is somewhat causing the disenfranchisement, because in order to get a nomination from, or at least on a national level, you have to appeal to those true Republicans, right, or the true Democrats, which are not representative of the vast majority of the people that
vote. What about on the local level? You have local Republicans, local Democrats. Don't
sure.
they have those same restrictions? Or
I don't know that on the local level it's that. I mean, because I guess you have the idea that all politics are local. But to some extent, you only have a select number of people that do vote in those primaries that put forth a candidate for everybody else to choose from at the national level. And so we see the people that have to appeal to the base and then to win the nomination, at least for the presidential elections, and then they now have to appeal to the vast majority of us who, American populace is usually pretty moderate. We like our presidents in the middle, and that's what Mike was referring to earlier. But now we've been sold this idea that everybody is going to be polarized and it's all extreme. And I don't know that the vast majority of us as Americans really fall into one of those two extreme sides of the political spectrum. Most of our presidents have been pretty close to the middle and moderate on their politics. And so I see that as maybe is what the issue is, not necessarily the parties are failing, but the nomination process is.
Paul, I just to that point, today, as we were recording this, it was just announced that Governor Walker, who has run and was elected as an independent, will be able to run in the Democratic primary. This is a statewide, fairly important election we're talking about. But what it represents is a very interesting, very specific example of the party process. Primaries have been important both to come up with a presidential candidate.
Bernie Sanders tapped into that.
But also to come up with a candidate for the governorship of the state of Alaska. And here we have what I think is fascinating. I'm looking forward to this because we have a person who was elected as an independent who will now, it appears, run as a candidate in the Democratic primary. And should he be elected in that primary, selected, then he will, as he has indicated, seek the support of Democrats, even though he's an independent. He's not a Democrat. Now, on the other side, the Republican group has a very interesting thing to deal with here because of the question about R versus D versus that vast group of I's in the middle. Is this a, you know, is this an indication that here in the state of Alaska, we're seeing people play with the two-party system in a very interesting way?
I think that was true in that when Walker teamed up with Malott, I mean, that was such a unusual thing.
People were stunned.
No, I was stunned and also kind of pleased.
Well, wasn't that more of an indication of the Democrats saying there's no other way we're going to be able to make this happen?
Well, we can't win unless... Well, neither one of them could have won, apparently. I think that was their calculation, wasn't it?
It was a party. And as we're talking about this, it's interesting because we almost anthropomorphize the party.
Yeah.
But there were people that sat down who were leaders in various parties and had to make this decision. Not only the candidates themselves, but the party. And then you have this other group of people who are in the party who are going to have to say, well, yeah, we agree with the leadership in making that decision, because it wasn't a vote of all Democrats in the state of Alaska about whether this was going to happen or not. And so once on board and rolling along, it was almost, in my sense, a sense of relief that people could say, oh, okay. We've got something here that now we can understand. So now we'll go into the process of running campaign.
Well, who will, if Walker runs in the Democratic primary, does he run as a Democrat then in the...
He's an independent running in the
That's very
the legal
sophisticated.
The decision was he could run as an independent in the Democratic primary.
Interesting.
So he does not have to be a registered Democrat.
Nope.
No, and he doesn't have to run then. If he wins the Democratic primary, he doesn't have to run as a Democrat. He can run as an...
He will be a candidate.
He will just get their endorsement.
Selected in there and will receive the endorsement and support of the Democratic Party. But he can continue being, as he has portrayed himself, as a person with a Democrat, as a lieutenant governor... But he's an independent, and although his history
is a Republican,
So what does that do to people who are trying to figure out how do I use? What aren't we talking?
To be the cynic that also perhaps taps him into Democratic national funding for running for governor.
Probably
at this time.
But this is the idea, you know, states as laboratories. Mm-hmm. That concept. Alaska is sort of a laboratory here, although the unique politics in Alaska, I mean, you can't win as a Democrat, I guess. But
the interesting thing about Alaska is that its constitution basically developed out of New Deal thinking. And so there's like a pretty socialist tinge to the way Alaska started out. Like we have our MEA, we have our co-ops, our MTA or co-ops, more so than utilities. That's one of the things that has happened in Alaska that has made this sort of unique.
And we're having this conversation because we've studied a little bit and we got some background knowledge about it. But I think about the person who isn't spending a lot of time this way, and what they want to make is a high level decision. It's metacognition. You just want to say, okay, if it's a D or an R, I'm going down and I'll support and I'll do the work. I don't want to have to think about all these details. I mean, that's the way we operate. We all operate. And I think it's going to be confusing for people.
There was an interesting interview of a teacher from Oklahoma who has gone on strike, or they've walked out. And he says he's a Republican, but he's fed up at the lack of funding because he has a classroom of 40 students and only 30 desks. He doesn't have enough textbooks to go around.
I have taught in Oklahoma under those circumstances. 45 students, 39 desks.
I've taught a class in our theater because I had 54 students before.
54. Okay. Sorry.
But he said that if a republic, if he would find a post with an R stamped to it, he would vote for that post as opposed to an incumbent. But my question to him, why do you need that R? You know, why are you so tribal here that you're willing to vote for a post if the R is attached to it? Couldn't you possibly vote for a D that was giving you some kind of reasonable agreement with your position? That just amazed me that he was so willing to vote as a Republican only that he was going to vote for a post.
And the reverse is true. Mm-hmm. I've known people who said I would never vote for anyone as an R if their name, but if it's a D, if it's a post, it doesn't matter. So once again, I think you're right when we talk about tribal, the whole question of how we operate psychologically. And so now we have that question of, as we're moving further, and do we even bring up Cambridge Analytica? Because that's part of the whole issue of the manipulation of people who are potential voters by parties. If you become very sophisticated, we sort of say, yeah, we know that advertisement, and we can recognize someone coming in and throwing a political thing at us. But now it becomes far more subtle in...
Well, identifying the particular ideological bend that this particular group has, I think, is what Cambridge Analytica did. And then they went ahead and designed their propaganda or their ads on Facebook and the other places, you know, by that discovery of those analytics. Anyway, let's move on here. We really did that one well. There are a number of single-party systems, such as the Nazis back in the 20s and 30s, communists continuing in Russia and China, the Ba'ath Party in Iraq before Saddam's fall, and multi-party system. We talked about that early, with parliamentary constitutions we see in Israel, Canada, most of Western Europe. But I don't know of any other strictly two-party system but us. Do you know of any other nation that has just as... It's a two-party system, and that's all? Anybody? Okay. Nobody does.
Whoa. When you say two-party, the United States has a dominant two-party system.
But, well, that's what I meant, a dominant two-party system.
But that doesn't, excuse the fact that if we were to look even at England, Great Britain.
England.
They essentially have a two-party system. With a weaker group. And the same may be said of some other, what we might term Western democracies, that there are two-party groups. They are not splintered as Italy, for example, where you have multiples. So I think there are other systems that are out
there. So you're saying the systems, how about Canada? Would you characterize as two?
I would, Canada.
A two-party system?
Sure.
One of the two parties, Conservatives and Labor?
Yeah, roughly.
Okay. And the other parties,
Trudeau did not have to put together a coalition.
Yeah, I would agree with Mike. I would think that you could identify England as well as Canada as predominantly two-party systems, just with a stronger third party. And to say that the United States is only a two-party system is a little bit misleading. I mean, we are a predominant two-party system, but with the emergence of like the Tea Party or the Green Party or the Libertarians or other groups, we do have third parties that emerge. It's just that
I got to challenge that. Isn't the Tea Party exclusively Republican? Have you seen the Tea Party do anything but align themselves with anybody but the Republicans?
I would actually advocate that the Tea Party is an extreme end of the Republicans that the mainstream Republicans wouldn't want to identify with. That could be they vied to try to take over the Republican Party, but they tried to create themselves as a viable entity outside of the Republican Party. That's why some of their candidates didn't run as Republicans anymore. They tried to run as Tea Party candidates.
In the Republican primaries, though.
Or even in general elections in other places outside of Alaska. But what you would see, though, is that what usually happens is as those third parties in the United States emerge and have something that becomes somewhat mainstream or other groups can start identifying with it, then their platform gets absorbed in large parts by the Democratic Party or by the Republican Party. And so they metastasize into that and becomes the new direction of it. Like the Green Party as an environmental party started off And that's now become a Democratic platform plank. Not solely, but that is part of it. And so they absorb some of those people that would have identified that
way. And that sort of happened historically with the Know-Nothings as well as the Progressives, the Progressive parties back in the,
sure.
in the 1920s.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Judy.
You can look at it another way, I think, that we have primarily two parties, I agree. Mm-hmm. And they're basically the only two parties that can for sure get on all the ballots for presidential elections in all the states, pretty much. But within those parties, we do have like the Tea Party faction, the Freedom Caucus, mm-hmm. and regular Republicans, and then that Koch brothers machine that some Republicans think is trying to take over for the Republican Party. And then, of course, there's Sanders and Clinton. So we have a lot of factions, but not a lot of separate parties. And I think that I tried to imagine, thinking about this, of a parliamentary system that could possibly work in this country. I mean, a two-party presidential election, for instance, is, except in the year 2000, is pretty much... there, it's decided. We know who's going to be the leader of the country. We know probably what direction the country might be taking. But like Angela Merkel, just getting that government together, how long after the election? I can't even imagine that in this country.
Sure. Well, and Austria has like 17 different political parties that hold seats in their parliament. So that concept right there is what Madison was talking about with hyperpluralism or pluralism. And so all these competing factions would keep fighting amongst themselves so that no one group could emerge and take over and dominate the government. And so in that sense, all the different factions within the Republican Party or the Democratic Party supposedly keep us so that they're vying for different avenues of support within their own political party. I think... maybe that's why we've seen it conglomerated into just two parties that haven't really emerged as a viable third party that we could see would replace. Like the Whigs get replaced with the Republicans, or the Democratic Republicans get replaced with the Jacksonian Democrats, and then later the Whigs come in there as that second party to work in there. And so we haven't seen that in a large system, but we have seen it within the party themselves. And I think the Tea Party is one of those newer factions that kind of emerged out to reframe what the Republican Party is trying to do.
And the reference to Jefferson, I just want to remind perhaps that he wasn't a party guy. The references suggest that he created a party. Parties weren't what he envisaged as a way to go forward. And people took off from him. But looking back at what he describes as a way to do things, was not with parties.
What he described and what he did could be argued as two different things.
Well, but I would still submit that Jefferson was not like some of the others of the founding members who were supportive of parties, etc. He was pretty jaundiced about thinking, okay, we're going to create a party that will run things. He was a people person, if you want, a populist and I think in both his writing and his actions, that's where he was. And I think that there is a line to be drawn to today, with one exception, and that is Jefferson's day, he didn't have a direct connect to the whole population. Today, if you put someone who's going to be called a populist or even a demagogue as a populist, because of the way we communicate, things have changed, and that's another theme that runs through all of this. What do we mean when we say a populist who wants to go to the people, and perhaps we have that kind of person in power today as a president who seems to be ignoring the party?
This is Bridging the Gap on KVRF Radio Free Palmer. Today we have Judy Donegan, Tony Jensen, and Mike Molesky talking about the two-party system. What is the relationship between the media and our status as a two-party system, past and present?
I think the role of the media has been greatly expanded because now, what Mike was just talking about, you have this instantaneous ability to get information. And when we started seeing like the 24-hour news channels be developed, they have to feed the cycle. They need to make money off their programming. And so they're constantly talking about things. And so media has always served as the gatekeeper, deciding what's going to be important that the people talk about and what's not. And so now we have this end of it. And the media constantly tells us how polarized that the legislature is. And so we're sold this idea that everybody's either a far-right Republican or a far-left Democrat, and there is no middle ground anymore, which, again, I don't believe that to be a true statement completely, but we spend all of our time focusing on the areas of disagreement between the political parties and then talk about gridlock and the inability to get anything done and bipartisanship and all these other things, when we see that a large majority of bills pass through the Senate and the House to some extent with both parties in almost total agreement. We only hear about that small percentage that are hotly contested, and we should, but that's what we focus on, and we see that that is the only thing. And so now we think everybody is on both sides or on one side or the other, and there is no middle, and then we start to believe it to be true. So then that's why you get people's like, I can't believe the Democrats did this. I can never vote for a D. I'm only going to vote for an R, or vice versa. And I think that perpetuates the problem to some extent.
But isn't it to some degree true, though, that there is a polarized aspect to our current Congress? I'm not saying that they're always reporting the truth on that dynamic.
Sure.
But there is some evidence to suggest that there's a polarization that occurs.
I think it's a self-perpetuating problem. I think that the media has told us that everybody's polarized, and so then you get the more extreme people. Again, for the primaries, you have to sell it to the base so that your base will actually support you, because if you can't get their nomination, then you can't even get in the general election. And so you get more polarized individuals that run because they know the bases will support them, and then you get the election, and a lot of people do, we call it a clothespin vote. It's like, I don't like either. I'm going to just plug my nose and vote for one, or they just choose to not turn out to vote.
Mike, you're the media here.
Well, as you were talking, I was thinking, okay, one of my reactions at the present time is I'm really bored. Not about this conversation. No, this is a fascinating conversation. What I'm bored about is looking at the variety of summary outlets, whether it's Huffington Post, CNN, Fox News, Politico, Reuters, on.
MSNBC, CNN, again,
right.
They're included.
I walk through those in the morning, skimming, and there's a sameness, and there's also a very thin layer of information there. So I'm thinking back in the day. I've lived in Europe, I've lived in D.C., and my day would start out with I'd read couple of newspapers, Washington Post, New York Times, the Herald in Europe, whatever. I would come away with what I felt was a more in-depth, more detailed background. So today, in defense of that, what I tend to do is I may read, well, recently, for example, many people know that Donald Trump was involved with the Miss Universe whole program, and for many years he owned it. He bought it, he owned it. But the detail about what did that mean? Recently there was a rather extensive article in the New Yorker that ran through where someone had spent a long time to put it all down without necessarily, I didn't think, saying this is a bad thing. There was a lot of discussion of the realities and facts, et cetera, that were part of it. And so I came away and I said, okay, now normally what I would have been doing is reading this kind of thing because I'd be using a newspaper rather than a quick fix by going to the computer and skimming through this way. And I said, that's a big difference. That's a huge difference. So that would be my response.
That's interesting about the New Yorker, too, running the more lengthy article. I mean, I do my news pretty much as you describe, I think, right now. And you pick up a New Yorker article on something, no matter how interesting, and suddenly these days it seems like it's just much too long because we're not used to that.
You're being conditioned here for the short
duration. Quick bite. And I think on your point about the media emphasizing polarization and the conflicts, that is what commercial media is all about. That's what makes a good, vigorous,
absolutely,
interesting story. It's what sells, yes, exactly.
Sensationalism.
So to report on the fact that the Democrats and the Republicans in the Senate passed some bill that I wouldn't even be able to name,
sure,
without any controversy, really, that is not going to make us watch CNN very long, I think. Okay. So,
is that going on at all? Are they passing anything in
the Senate?
In Congress?
Yeah. Oh, the Senate still passes a number of things. The House and the Senate combined, obviously, pass a number of things.
Recently, they did the budget. What else have they done? The tax cut, yeah.
Oh, and I couldn't tell you exactly, but in 2000, or in the 114th Congress, so the one that ended in 2017, they passed like 379 bills over the course of the 2 years. And then they had a number, like another 800 or so non-binding resolutions. So they're constantly doing the business. Most of it is somewhat pro forma, and so they just do it. But there are things that they discuss. It's just that it's not controversial for them. It's not something that they're going to have a large opposition. So it passes like with a few people that disagree, but the vast majority of them will agree. And the House does – it's a little bit more disputed in the House just because the House is so – it's so large and there's so many different viewpoints in the House compared to just the 100 in the Senate. But we do see a lot of things pass. It's just that that's not what gets reported because, again, that's not what's going to sell. We want to know where the conflict is. And it's not that I think the media is bad. I don't. It is that because as wonderful as technology is, it allows us to be lazier about our knowledge. And so where Mike was talking about reading three or four different news sources in the morning just to get his day started, what do? A lot of people scroll through their Facebook feeds. And what are you seeing? You see the things that you liked. And so you're going to get streamed stuff that is already your opinion. So when we talk about like Cambridge Analytica and sending stuff to you, you've already predisposed yourself as to what it is that you want to read anyway. And so they're just tapping into that even more. But you are still making those choices about what it is that you chose to read. And most of us will only read the things that we already like, as opposed to going out and finding that opposite point of view. And it's like, oh, not that it's supposed to change what you believe, but at least now I know why I still like what I like. And so, you know, pick a side, that's fine, but at least be informed about why the other side has their opinion and know why you support your side other than it's just a D next to the name or an R next to the name. That would be what I would advocate, at least.
Is the direction of these two parties, I'm talking about the Democrats and the Republicans, determined by principled positions on the issue of ideological beliefs or by the whims of the national leader of the respective party at that particular time? What is a bigger motivator of these two parties, the ideology of their positions on issues or the leader's desires?
We're dodging around an elephant in the room.
We are.
A few times.
Well, how do you bring out the elephant then?
And that's the real question of the impact of the present presidency on the two-party system.
But I'm also asking, is that just unique to this president or is that – go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted there.
Well, I would say there's one unique quality. There may be others, but the one that I think is absolutely defining, if you will, is the tendency to tweet what appear to be important pronouncements or even leads into policy changes, etc., and to watch and I scratch my head and watch as it appears that that process where someone in the past, as a president, whoever it was, would have had a meeting with the people around him, and they would coordinate something and go out. And occasionally you would have someone who'd go rogue. But that's been turned around. Now it's catch up. And I think that's, you know, I have worked in D.C. I have friends that are still there. And what I'm trying to come up with, and I will be better placed, I'm going to the air in 2 weeks and spend some time to understand if what we're looking at is so different, or are we just saying, yeah, it's really like other things, maybe a little stronger. And I'm leaning toward the direction of saying it really is different.
Okay, Tony, you don't think it's different?
I think I would agree with Mike in that it's somewhat different. But we could go back to Teddy Roosevelt in the bully pulpit, mm-hmm. right? Or FDR in the fireside chats, or other presidents. One of the ways that the president gains power, because constitutionally the president's power is extremely limited. And so one of the ways that the president always gains power is through a mandate of the people. And so if the president can appeal to the people directly, then the congressmen tend to fall in line because they ride the presidential coattails. So if the president is popular, they'll get reelected. And when we talk about do they follow their ideology or do they follow something else, some party platform or things like that, they follow how they're going to get reelected. I mean, Washington talked about the idea that we shouldn't have professional politicians, and that went by the wayside as soon as we started getting elections coming in. And so we do have professional politicians, and they do look to see how they're going to get reelected. And some of that is what's going to bring in the donors' money for them. And sometimes it's going to be if the president's really popular and or not. Like President Bush, for example, following the September 11th attacks, prior to that, he had been running at about 54% in the job approval rating polls, popularity polls, and so on. He's about average, maybe a little bit lower than average. His response as a leader to the September 11th attacks, we're going to find who did this, we're going to bring them to justice, and so on. His popularity rating shot up to almost unprecedented heights. What was the result of that? We got the Patriot Act, probably one of the worst pieces of legislation we've had passed. And it passed because everybody was going to get on board with what President Bush said because he was so popular. If they wanted to get reelected, they were going to do what he said.
You were also pretty scared by 9/11.
Well, absolutely. But there's been enough of that. As I said, if you let fear just dictate whether or not you're going to maintain your safety, then maybe you're not deserving of either.
Yeah.
But as an example of where they're going to get their ideas about what they're going to pass, and it's not even just a President Bush thing, because President Obama allowed it to be reauthorized because he thought there's some things in there for safety, and mm-hmm. so he was popular, and the Congress, knowing that it was already a bad piece of legislation, still continued to allow it to be reauthorized under his direction. So I don't think it's a one party or another party, but it is really the popularity of it, because by the time President Bush was ready to leave office, he was so unpopular, he could have had the best idea for a bill in the world and Congress would have never taken it up. Even his own political party had completely shunned him. And so right now, I think with Trump, nobody knows quite exactly what's going to happen. And so they're just kind of playing catch up like Mike talked about. And they're trying to figure out, well, is his idea a popular one so we can follow it and maybe try to push it forward? Or is it something we need to distance ourselves from? Because you've seen a lot of flip-flopping. Like Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, I don't know. Sometimes he's in favor of him, and sometimes he's adamantly opposed. And he's a fairly staunchly conservative individual, and we don't know what he's going to do. So he's definitely not just following what the president says.
Sometimes you think he's principled. Sometimes you think he sold his soul to the devil. Sorry, Lindsey. Go ahead, Judy.
Well, I was just thinking that the opposite kind of happens too. Mm-hmm. In that I think there are Republicans who find some of the things that President Trump does to be a little bit appalling, mm-hmm. at least. And but they, like McConnell and Paul Ryan, they're not going to stand up to him because they think that he will sign some of the things they want done.
Sure.
And so that's how they got the tax bill. They're not going to confront him. Although I was interested in on these tariffs and so on, the Chamber of Commerce that is a relatively Republican organization, is opposed to what's happening there and has said so. So I don't know, but I think it was Dole when he was running for president sometime, you can probably know when, that he said, you know, party platform, I haven't even read it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, I have a metaphor that it captures something of my own feeling. Many of you have driven down the road, and perhaps you have come to a stretch of black ice. And as you've done that, maybe you started turning one way, and then you began to fishtail. And there was an oscillation that occurred as it got bigger and bigger. If you corrected well, you got out of it. But if you didn't, you just spun right out. And that's what I feel like today. I'm thinking there's an oscillation going on. I think Tony's description of other times is true. I wasn't alive with Teddy Roosevelt. So part of our problem is that, yes, in the past there have been something like this. And the real question still remains for me is the oscillation increasing because of the way media works, whether it's social media and other media, and that's the thing that makes it so difficult. Can we come out of the oscillation to a point where we're at least moving along and have some sense that we're
things are okay?
Well, we're addressing issues and can see something happening, whether it's a trade or a budget or whatever, rather than oscillating. And that's my sum.
Okay, do you have any different points in history where you say this oscillation ended up, or is this currently the only time of oscillation that you're identifying?
This is the biggest. It's profound in my mind, looking on, only because I'm not seeing the kinds of corrective actions that can be easily taken, and in some case, I think, emphasized by the personality and actions of the president, which seems to be part of a modus operandi. So we're looking and saying, well, we have other, whether it's the Supreme Court or Congress or various other groups that would normally buffer this kind of thing. So a person couldn't just have decide to go here and then in the opposite direction back and forth. And I'm not right now feeling a lot of confidence in those buffers. I'm saying that's what I want to see.
Well, that leads me to this next question, which is a bipartisan decision to acknowledge the criminality of Richard Nixon led to his resignation. Does this Republican Party have the capability of acknowledging the evidence, if there is evidence, of Trump's complicity in criminal activity? Can they acknowledge this as currently constructed?
If the public demands it, then yes. Right now, I don't believe that the public is demanding that completely. And so that's why I think you do see some of this wavering back and forth.
How would sometimes that demand be expressed? How would you hear that from the public?
Well, similar to how you started off the whole conversation with the Parkland students, you know, at times what Mike was just talking about, you know, oscillations and so on, and there might not be a huge one that we're seeing like we are currently that we can reference back to, but there's been a number of times like this where we kind of fight for the morality of our country, however we perceive that to be. And so the people do come out and demand different things. Maybe the civil rights movement, it started off smaller but then became a nationwide thing. Or women's suffrage or things like that. I think we can point to bigger things like that that we can say that the people have demanded this needs to happen. And so maybe we'll see in November if they vote differently, and then the Republican Party or whomever is going to come back and say, oh, yeah, maybe we can't really just kind of brush this aside and go the way that we have been. And that would be my hope. And not to wait till November, but hopefully that can happen at some point in time, that the people demand this of their of their legislators who represent them, because that is our job as citizens, is to demand that of our representation.
When could I ask you a question, Tony?
Sure.
When because I don't know the answer. When Nixon was impeached, was there a Democratic House? That Sorry.
I think there was.
I think there was too.
Peter Rodino was a Republican, I believe, who was asking some tough questions.
But I think that that's, you know, what we've got now is this single party going on, which I think makes it harder for the Congress to react, or makes it they're unwilling to. But as you, I mean, maybe waiting till November, if there is a shift in either house.
So you believe the people have a chance to make a statement based on their ability to vote this November?
Of course they do, if they will.
And I think that's that. I think that's the furthest off that we would see this.
Really?
I would think that it either needs to start currently or it could start currently. But I think November, with the elections, the midterms are going to be your last big opportunity, at least for this first cycle, to see whether or not that the people are going to demand some answers or some definitive direction from this.
The November election, the defining moment. Mike, we have about, 30 seconds?
Right.
So you got the last word.
It's instructive to note that many Democrat leaders have not been pushing impeachment and waiting quite clearly for November.
This is Bridging the Gap. We talked about the two-party system. We have Mike Maleski, Tony Jensen, and Judy Donegan.
Thanks for listening to Bridging the Gap. We welcome diversified perspectives. If you are interested in becoming a panelist for a future show, send us an email to manager@radiofreepalmer.org.
This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters.